of nowhere.
All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 629. It's me and Jason today, and we're going to be covering, I guess the tack we're going to take is kind of pseudo-spirituality that started to be a big thing in the 60s. But underlying it all, we're really looking at where the social engineering goes rampant, and it goes rampant to deal with the massive generation of young people from the so-called boomers, the oldest boomers, baby boomers, who are no longer accepting the mainstream ways, and they're hardcore against war. And everybody knows what the USA does with war. It never stops. Anyhow, welcome, Jason.
And a rather hot good day.
Wish I could say that. I have been waiting for weeks now for a sunny day to film, and I'm still waiting.
I'm looking forward to a potential thunderstorm in the afternoon.
Well, yesterday we were supposed to have a nor'easter, which I guess we kind of did. It wasn't very bad, but here's the thing. Apparently, north of me, it snowed. So there's that. Snow in May for those folks. All right. Well, anything you want to mention before we jump in? I think we're picking up on the cusp of the 60s here.
We are. Well, we're going to be getting into a bit of backstory first on all of this. But I named it the faking of spirituality for our notes, but it wasn't entirely faking it. It was more like the co-opting of it. But a lot of the things that come about later are definitely just kind of made up.
To me, what you're going to get into, particularly as it relates to India, was I suspect, and this is totally just my view based on things I've read and what I study, the powers that be really didn't want Western youth getting into real branches of spirituality that was effective. That's what I think happened. And we'll get into it when the Beatles go off to smoke dope in India and all the rest of it.
Well, it makes sense that they wouldn't want anyone getting into these kinds of concepts because it's definitely a lot more about free thinking and things like that, which means you're not going along with the program that they might be pushing.
Well, we live under the remnants of this idea right now. I consider all that old spirituality to be in the vein of mind sciences. And it's not fake. It is amazing at level. Like people ask, how do they know there were rings on Saturn? They didn't have telescopes. Well, they witnessed it firsthand because they were involved in the mind sciences. But here's the rub. Christianity, which by the way, is mentioned in Yogananda's book, Autobiography of a Yogi, Christianity was big into the mind sciences beyond our reckoning in history. And you're never told that. And you're actually told that that's the unchristian way. And, you know, it's a whole different ballgame. But there was a time when these types of spirituality that have an absolute effect were squeezed out of the traditions of the modern era.
Well, I might be so bold as to suggest that that was also intentionally squeezed out of those philosophies.
Oh, I think so. I mean, the most we can remember, or maybe I should just say I can remember from what I was taught, and I was brought up Christian, is I'm familiar with way back in the day, monks taking a vow of silence. That's a form of the mind sciences. The idea that monks would lock themselves in cells for periods of time, that is also connected to the mind sciences. But you're never told why. It just seems like an extravagant thing that somebody did to prove their faith or something like that. There's much, much more to it. And that's pretty much been removed from the Christian tradition.
So as you're going to see, this goes hand in hand along with a lot of the other stuff that we've covered already. This is just a certain section of it. And there were some great ideas that had gotten into Western culture that, of course, were then infiltrated and co-opted into a different direction from what it should have been. And it's just a damn shame, really.
It is. There was a generation there that wanted to change the world for the better, and they got worked hard. And I don't think we can really point the finger at them because every generation since has had similar experience and had a similar downfall up against the powers that be and the social engineering. You know, where culture goes, most places go with it. And that's all tied down to the music and everything else, the film, you know, just how culture is created.
All right. So do you have anything to say about this before we get into the notes proper? Because this is really your kind of thing. Not that I'm not into spiritual concepts, but a lot of this is stuff that you're very much into.
I'll point out what I can as we go along. And one of the big things is going to be a spiritual figure named Babaji, who is an avatar, which means he didn't die. And that goes to the album cover of Sgt. Pepper's. And I just found out recently that Babaji also made it to the cover of George Harrison's Dark Horse album, but we'll get there.
In the 1960s and 1970s, the Western nations saw a desire for alternative spiritual systems, particularly those that were coming from ancient Indian philosophies. This new outlook was coming predominantly from the youth of that era, but it certainly was not limited to just them. This desire for something else was stemming from a confluence of cultural, social, and political factors that had begun in the 1950s, but came to a head in the mid-1960s. The 1960s were marked by widespread distrust in traditional Western institutions, such as government, religion, and capitalism, due to events like the Vietnam War, civil rights struggles, and perceived materialism. Many, especially young people, sought meaning beyond the conventional Christianity or secular frameworks of their parents and began turning to Eastern philosophies, such as Buddhism and Hinduism, for their emphasis on inner peace and transcendence. This may have been a great idea at first, but we will see how, like so many things in this world, it was co-opted from what could have been into a controlled and rather destructive narrative that left many by the mid-1970s feeling disillusioned with it all and succumbed to many worldly temptations instead of becoming the enlightened beings they could have been.
Well, that's it in a nutshell. The idea that there was a lot of young people that were not going to accept the mainstream ways. They were hard against war. But I almost wonder if the whole psychedelic thing was put together. Look at all the artwork that goes with Buddhism and Hinduism, how colorful it is. And, you know, it almost feels to me like the psychedelic movement was to corrupt all that. But let's keep in mind, I'm gonna say a thing. I'm not certain it's right, but if I'm not mistaken, the Beatles are the first time we hear sitar music, and someone's probably going to look that up. I think I'm right. I might not be, but I'm reasonably sure the Beatles bring us sitar music, and that's really the first big mainstream connection to India that I'm aware of. And I should add, everybody knows what the Beatles are. They were a construct. They were a Tavistock construct, formed and brought together, from my point of view, to corrupt the young generation. And it worked.
So the first song was Norwegian Wood in 1965.
Yeah, I was actually going to say that, but I wasn't sure enough. I had it in my mind that it might have been somewhere else. And by the way, Ravi Shankar becomes really the face of sitar players through George Harrison. But if you want your mind blown, go do a little investigation about people like Ravi Shankar and how they were trained and what they had to go through. I mean, it's beyond boot camp almost. It's crazy how hardcore their musical training was. And then learn a little bit about the sitar. I guess we could suffice it to say it did show up in Western music, but there was nobody that I'm aware of even coming close to playing that instrument at the levels it was designed for.
To fully explore the topic at hand, we will need to step back even further than the age of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. On August 15th, 1947, India achieved independence from British colonial rule after nearly two centuries, which marked the end of the British Raj and the birth of India as a sovereign nation. This followed a long struggle that was led by figures like Mahatma Gandhi, Jawaharlal Nehru, and others, with Gandhi's philosophy of nonviolent resistance gaining worldwide attention. India's independence is looked upon as a landmark in the worldwide decolonization movement that inspired other nations and drew international focus to Indian culture, history, and spiritual traditions along the way. The independence movement in India, especially Gandhi's nonviolent campaigns, was extensively covered by Western media. Gandhi's ascetic lifestyle and spiritual rhetoric, which was rooted in Hindu and Jain principles like ahimsa, which means nonviolence, and satyagraha,
which means truth and resistance,
introduced Western audiences to Indian philosophical concepts. As India emerged as a nation, its ancient traditions, such as yoga, meditation, and texts like the Bhagavad Gita and Upanishads, gained visibility. Western intellectuals and spiritual seekers began to view India as a repository of timeless wisdom, which contrasted mightily with the materialism of post-World War II societies.
To say the least, I mean, the West is going full materialism. In the 50s, there's going to be a new level of living in America. And we've said it a lot of times. Dad goes to work, mom stays home, there's a car for both of them, a house. It was much easier. And there were all these new things like washing machines and just all these appliances and stuff, material stuff. But what always strikes me is, you know, it's claimed, oh, India got their independence from Britain. But I once read a few years ago, and I couldn't believe it when I read it, that the Indians will tell you there's no written history. And I thought, how can that be? They have some of the oldest languages and other things, but there is a claim that there's no written history. And I've always wondered, did Britain scrub it or something while it was in control of anything there? How could it possibly be that such an ancient place with some of the most ancient languages is lacking so much of the written history? And I think this may play into what we experience now with the false histories. I think there were people working to take control, and they didn't want anyone to have a view of how amazing some of the historical past is, particularly in a place like India, where you can go there today, see the most amazing temple you've ever witnessed carved out of a single piece of rock, and sit there and just say, how? How was this done? If you read books like the one Yogananda wrote, you will hear over and over that it was in the time of the rishis. Now, the rishis apparently is from an unknown time. I've read different accounts, but mostly we're not quite sure how long ago it was. But the claim from the Indians who live in India is that they had advanced to spiritual levels that are beyond belief. And that's how things like those temples came to be. But here we are in the modern era with next to nothing to go on other than guesses.
And if I'm not mistaken, didn't the concept of the triune God first come out of Indian philosophies?
Well, there's going to be a lot of people who make this claim, but I want to be careful here because it's usually brought up in a way to down someone's spiritual tradition or another. So what I choose to do is I go to nature to simply underscore the importance of three. And I've done it a lot of times. I want to make something. I have a dot. Can't make anything. So I put another dot. Now I got a line. Can't make anything. Oop, third dot goes down. Now you're cooking with oil. There's a triangle. Now you can start to create things. And that's one very simplistic demonstration of why three is important. And so, yeah, there are a lot of very old traditions that have the triune idea.
There are. And I just took a quick look up, and it looks like the original concept comes from Sumeria, and that from India, supposedly later, comes the concept of the Trimurti, which I believe we've actually covered before.
We did. But then again, you know, I don't even think we can get agreement on what actually is the oldest consistent culture. I think you'll hear different points of view and different claims. There are a lot of people, particularly in the Eastern world, who think India is it.
That's kind of what I was getting at. And if indeed they don't have a written history that goes back that far, then it's really not something you can argue about anyway, because you don't have any evidence to point to.
What I think is probably true is they absolutely had written things. And when they were being taken over by Britain, they probably hid it away. That would be my best guess.
The Theosophical Society, which had been founded in 1875 by Helena Blavatsky and Henry Olcott, had already been popularizing Indian spirituality in the West for many years. After 1947, its emphasis on Buddhist and Hindu concepts like karma and reincarnation gained broader traction as India's global profile was rising. Post-1947, Western universities were expanding studies of Indian philosophy and religion. Translations of Hindu and Buddhist texts, such as the Vedas, Upanishads, and Dhammapada, became more accessible, which fueled intellectual curiosity. the newly independent Indian government began promoting its cultural heritage through diplomatic channels and began sending artists, scholars, and spiritual figures abroad. This laid the groundwork for later visits by Indian gurus like Swami Prabhupada and Maharishi Mahesh Yogi that would take place in the 1960s. Independence encouraged Indian migration to the West, particularly to the UK and US, where communities introduced Buddhist and Hindu practices, such as temple worship and meditation, to the local populations. The increased awareness of Indian spirituality in the late 1940s and 1950s would set the stage for what would be coming with the 1960s counterculture. Early teachers, such as Indra Devi, who opened a yoga studio in Hollywood in 1947, began introducing yoga to Western audiences, capitalizing on the post-independence fascination with Indian practices that was growing year by year.
You know, it almost feels to me like before this period of time we're talking about, there wasn't much of an idea in this part of the world about things like karma and reincarnation, and the spiritual traditions that we follow in the West certainly didn't dwell on these things. But there are a couple writings in the Upanishads and the Dhammapada. I would recommend, like, the Dhammapada is a very good example. It's an easy, easy read, and it spurs thought. I'll just say that much. I think everyone should read the Dhammapada or have a good idea of some of these Eastern concepts. Every time they've come to our shores, there's been a lot of interest, but unfortunately, the social engineering groundwork that was laid probably before this time, certainly before this time, did everything it could to kind of abrogate what it actually was. And I'll say another thing. From my experience, every culture that I've ever witnessed that has to do with meditation is far more peaceful a culture. And up to this time, I guess I would guess that meditation, there wasn't much of it in the United States.
Emerging in the post-World War II United States, the Beat Generation was a literary and cultural movement that was led by writers like Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, and William S. Burroughs. Being disillusioned by the conformity, materialism, and militarism of 1950s America, they sought alternative lifestyles and spiritualities, rejecting mainstream Western values. The Beats were drawn to Eastern spiritual traditions, particularly Hinduism and Zen Buddhism, as sources of liberation, spontaneity, and cosmic connection. The 1950s saw rising interest in non-Western thought, being fueled by worldwide decolonization, the popularization of yoga, and the influence of figures like D.T. Suzuki, who introduced Zen Buddhism to the West. The Beats amplified this trend through their influential writings. During the 1950s, poet Allen Ginsberg and novelist Jack Kerouac began exploring Eastern philosophies in their works, with Kerouac's Dharma Bums from 1958 serving as a seminal text. Their writings introduced Indian spiritual concepts and Zen to Western audiences, which put down much of the groundwork for the 1960s countercultural fascination with Indian mysticism, especially since several of the prominent Beat figures would still be spreading their influence within the burgeoning counterculture movement during the mid-1960s. Dharma Bums popularized the image of the rucksack wanderer, a spiritual seeker who rejected materialism for a life of hitchhiking, poetry, and meditation. This began resonating with young Americans who were feeling disillusioned by the Cold War and consumer culture. The novel introduced terms like dharma and karma to a broader Western audience, making Indian philosophy seem accessible and relevant. Its vivid depictions of Zen-inspired mountain climbs and communal living foreshadowed the 1960s hippie communes and back-to-the-land movements.
All right, we can sum this little Beat Generation thing pretty easily. Here come the drugs. Here comes the drugging of America for the first time on a level that's going to matter. Not only is it going to matter, it's going to carry up to this very day. The pusher back then, you had to sneak around to find them. The pusher now is right at your CVS or one of the pushers. But words have meaning. And for anyone who's looked into Eastern spiritual traditions, they know what the word dharma means. And I've got news for Mr. Kerouac. The word dharma and bums, they don't belong together. That's like mixing oil and water. So you can see what's going on here. It is my interpretation of what the Beat generation, like Kerouac, they were co-opted by the social engineers. That is my personal point of view. I don't know do you agree with that, Jason?
Yeah, well, the unfortunate thing with Jack Kerouac especially, he was a drunk. It's sad to say.
Well, that's one of the nicer things you could say. They're going to introduce some of the most mind-altering drugs there are. They're going to put LSD. Here comes the drugs. And in the 50s, were there drugs around? Yeah, but it wasn't anywhere near mainstream. It was such a shadowy thing that it wasn't an issue.
It was smoking grass at the jazz clubs.
Right. Someone was smoking a joint, a spliff, Mary Jane. It wasn't a big deal. And particularly for those of people who have smoked pot before, the quality of the pot back then isn't even in the same universe as the power of the pot now. But to get to the point, here we are timestamping the Beat generation, queuing up for the coming of hippies. And I can't think of a better way to intro in other than saying, here come the drugs, big time.
In 1955, British author Aldous Huxley publishes The Doors of Perception, a short but influential essay that recounted his experience taking the psychedelic drug mescaline in 1953. The title, which was drawn from William Blake's poem, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, reflects Huxley's exploration of altered states of consciousness as a gateway to mystical insight. Since the 1950s in the West were marked by post-World War II conformity, materialism, and Cold War anxieties, there was a sparking interest in Eastern philosophies, including Buddhism and Hinduism, that was fueled by India's 1947 independence and the Beat Generation's writings. Aldous Huxley, who was a longtime student of Indian spirituality, bridged these trends by connecting psychedelics to mystical traditions. He is considered a prolific writer and intellectual and had explored Indian philosophies since the 1930s, being influenced by Vedanta, which is a Hindu philosophical tradition, and the teachings of Swami Prabhavananda, with whom he had studied in California. His earlier works, like The Perennial Philosophy from 1945, synthesized Buddhist, Hindu, and Western mystical ideas, which set the stage for the release of The Doors of Perception. To be blunt, Aldous Huxley presented psychedelics as a shortcut to mystical experiences that were traditionally accessed through years of meditation or asceticism in Indian traditions. This idea resonated with a generation who were seeking alternatives to Christianity and secularism. The book would also go on to inspire figures like Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, who would later rename himself Ram Dass, who would popularize LSD as a means to achieve spiritual awakening in the 1960s, often citing Indian texts along the way. The Beats, including Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac, are said to have read Huxley's work, incorporating the ideas into their own explorations of Eastern spirituality.
Oh, Huxley. In and around the wheels of power. Jason, why don't you take a second to remind people who Mr. Huxley is?
Mr. Huxley, along with his brother Julian, were, for lack of any other description, globalists, early elitists.
They are one of the wheels in the social engineering sprocket. And so Mr. Huxley brings us The Doors of Perception. Let me draw the lines. So if I'm not mistaken, the band The Doors gets its name from this, The Doors of Perception.
This is the end, my only friend, the end.
There it is. So Mr. Jim Morrison pulls the name of his band from this guy who is at the hub of the powers that be. Let's just put it that way. Mr. Morrison's father is an admiral. He does the false flag event that pulls us into Vietnam conflict, and he lies about it. They later get caught with I think it's called the Pentagon Papers. Anyone can look it up. So there's the lines being drawn. But what's more is this guy who's supposedly trained under this guy or that guy is bringing LSD to the table and telling the young people, instead of a lifetime of spiritual endeavor, you just take this dope here that I'm handing you, and it's a shortcut. And damage was done. And from my point of view, it was intended damage. Unfortunately, the damage that was done by choice. They chose to do it. And we are still reaping the benefits of what went on back then.
The impact of all these things changed Western society forever.
Yeah.
A lot of people look back on this time with rosy glasses, but it was also a time of turmoil.
So let's list it out. It was a time of turmoil. There were constantly terrible things going on in the world, and that's why the young people weren't down with the mainstream, or at least part of it. But another thing was there was freedom. There was a lot of respect between individuals and American society back then. But what did we lose? Well, in this period of time that you're edging into, because of the people we're talking about and the social engineers who pulled off the Hail Mary, I don't think they could have done a much better job than what they set out to do. They broke the family unit. And now, as they tell you, we're approaching however many hundreds of billions of people. I am of a mind that population on the global scale, or the worldwide scale, I guess I should say, has been falling since the 70s for most of the big industrial parts of the world. But they broke the family unit, they introduced drugs, and they shifted the entire culture into a very, very unhelpful mindset. And they did a lot of it through the cultural things like the writings of the beat poets. The music was dead center, the foundations of it. And it all leaked out in every direction, from art to film to you have it. And it worked. And it was maybe, from my point of view, the most successful social engineering that's ever been pulled off in the modern era.
There's something else that you've mentioned numerous times that I think a lot of people forget about, and that's that things were generally safer all the way through the 60s until the whole Manson situation, and people were doing things like hitchhiking, and it was, for the most part, safe.
It was absolutely safe. Everybody hitchhiked everywhere. This would be a far different world if we didn't have a fearful media machine and a disgusting film tradition that shows constant violence and guns and war. If we didn't have entertainment in the way we do and news in the way we do, the average person probably wouldn't see many deaths in an entire lifetime, let alone the number of shootings we see because of the things I just mentioned. But I would almost draw the line in America at Manson. In my memory, the first time you begin to see bars on windows and stuff like that in this country is right after the Manson hoax, skit, false flag event. Remember, Tarantino just rewrote the end of what happened with Manson? So let me ask you a question. If that was real and people had babies cut out of them and this gruesome butchery that was described in the media to all the world, if that had really gone on, is some director in Hollywood going to come rewrite that for entertainment as if it's just something you do? But it also did another thing. The hippie generation ended. The moment that happened, the hippies were going to be persona non grata. The image of what they were before that and what they were after that was, the movie that I just referenced, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, does a pretty good job of showing how the hippies are beginning to be viewed. You should be afraid of them. They're dirty. They're lazy. They don't work. They're drugged out. And look what can happen. So that whole thing, in my mind, is the social engineering at work.
The civil rights movement in the United States began in 1954 and ran until 1968, and aimed to abolish legalized racial segregation, discrimination, and disenfranchisement in the country. This most commonly affected African Americans, with the movement having origins in the Reconstruction era in the late 19th century, and more modern roots in the 1940s. As the decade of the 1960s begins, key events from 1960 to 1963 were exposing deep systemic inequalities, galvanizing activists, and challenging the moral and social foundations of American society. While the post-World War II era saw rising prosperity in the U.S., with the decade of the 1950s considered to be the pinnacle of the American dream, the civil rights movement's revelations of injustice clashed with this idealized American dream, which prompted many, especially younger people, to question Western values like consumerism, institutional authority, and organized religion. The movement's emphasis on justice, community, and moral purpose resonated with some who sought alternative spiritual systems, including Indian philosophies like Buddhism and Hinduism, which offered non-materialistic, universalist perspectives.
I think most people now are not old enough to remember one aspect of what we're talking about here, and that was the commune. So many of the young generation in and around the hippie movement truly had walked away from materialism. They were banding together and joining. At the time, most of them were called communes, where they all ganged together, they gardened, they took care of them. It's kind of like almost the off-grid idea now, to be honest with you. But unfortunately, the drugs were already mixed in with it. But that was demonized. And, you know, I remember reports of, oh, they're acting like communists or whatever they were doing. But my point here is the young generation had a true desire to get away from war, to get away from materialism. And they were, in fact, doing things that are maybe equivalent in a weird way to what we see now when people move off grid to get the heck away from all the things that they don't like systemically. That went on for quite some time, but it seems to have only made it through the 70s or maybe even into the mid or late 70s. And then it all came crashing down like everything else.
By 1961, U.S. involvement in the Vietnam conflict was escalating after beginning in 1955. This marked a turning point in the not really a war's intensity, and its impact on American society was definitely becoming noticeable. The moral and political controversies regarding Vietnam led many to question Western values like militarism, materialism, and institutional authority, which was creating a receptive audience for alternative worldviews that had already been gaining a foothold. Early in 1961, much of the American public was still supporting U.S. involvement, as they viewed it as a necessary stand against the ever-looming threat of communism. However, skepticism was growing among intellectuals, students, and activists who were now questioning the war's moral and strategic basis. Small but definitely vocal protests were beginning on college campuses, being led by groups like the Students for a Democratic Society. These early demonstrations were putting down the groundwork for the massive anti-war movement that would be coming in the mid-1960s. News reports with images of Vietnam's violence, though less graphic than would be seen later in the decade, started to challenge official narratives, sowing seeds of public doubt about government honesty. This also began to make a divide between the older and younger generations, a situation that would deepen and worsen as the decade continued. College students, who were facing the draft and were getting exposed to anti-war ideas through campus activism, began questioning government authority. This distrust extended to broader institutions, which included those tied to Western values, such as capitalism and organized religion.
People can go back to some of our older episodes where we point out how early on some of the major universities in the American university system were taken over by the powers that be. And what basically happened here was there were huge, huge numbers of young people at universities and otherwise burning their draft cards, leaving the country to go to Canada so they couldn't be drafted, making arguments of why they shouldn't be drafted. And that was all infiltrated at the universities. And by the way, LSD comes into the picture. And from my point of view, I think a lot of that LSD, like people like Timothy Leary, were a part of the university system. I think a lot of that LSD was probably made on university campuses in the chemistry labs, but it gets infiltrated and it's hard to describe now what was going on back then. And in terms of the violence on television, it got worse and worse and worse as the decade went on. And it's almost horrific what was coming through the 6 p.m. newscast every night into America's living rooms. Incredible. Even on the cover of Life magazine, I remember when I was very young, a picture of a little Vietnamese girl with her clothes burned off, running down the streets. That was on the cover of Life magazine.
Now, the anti-war movement that was starting in the early 1960s is not the same anti-war movement by the end of the 60s. This is actually something that Dave McGowan describes pretty accurately, I would say, where it started as a real grassroots organic movement with people really not liking what was going on. But then these long-haired, drugged-out people start showing up, and the real anti-war people, the original anti-war people, are asking questions. What's going on here? Who are these people? Why are they here?
Exactly. And McGowan does a very good job of proving that this is true. I think one of the things he does is he shows a boutique in Hollywood that is already putting things on the rack, on the shelf to sell that will become the look and feel of the hippie movement, which hasn't even happened yet. And this is why I have said from my outset in the public eye, do not join groups. And I mean that in a general way. If what you're doing is important to you and truth is important to you, don't hitch your wagon to a group to do that, because it has been shown over and over that once a group is there, if it begins to matter, it will be infiltrated. And in this case, I mean, McGowan does a fantastic job, but let's be honest, what are the things that brought that whole movement to its knees? One of the main things is drugs, right? But that whole hippie movement, according to McGowan's work, was preconceived and put in place, ready for all those young people to come and join it and take part in a thing that was created to control them and to basically cut them off at the knees.
It was either preconceived or minimally steered in the direction that the controllers wanted it to go.
I'm of a mind that it's preconceived, all of it.
On September 27th, 1962, the book Silent Spring, which was written by marine biologist Rachel Carson, was published by Houghton Mifflin. The book set out to expose the environmental and human health dangers of synthetic pesticides, particularly DDT, and criticized the chemical industry's unchecked practices. Silent Spring's emphasis on ecological interconnectedness and the need for harmony with nature resonated with Indian spiritual traditions, particularly Buddhism and Hinduism, which emphasized unity with the natural world and non-harm. This alignment helped fuel interest in Indian philosophies among environmentally conscious youth in the 1960s and 1970s. Silent Spring is widely credited with launching the modern environmental movement, as it emphasized the delicate balance of ecosystems and argued that human actions ripple through nature. Carson wrote, quote, "In nature, nothing exists alone," highlighting a holistic view that is akin to Indian philosophical principles. Carson was challenging the post-World War II faith in technological and industrial progress, questioning the assumption that science could dominate nature without any sort of consequences. She advocated for humility and respect for natural systems. Silent Spring urged readers to rethink humanity's relationship with the environment, advocating for sustainable practices and greater accountability from industry and government. This, of course, is certainly not a bad thing.
No, it's not. And as you're reading this, I'm having all these flashbacks. There used to be an ad on TV that was so famous of an Indian, and I think later it was found the guy who played the Indian wasn't an Indian. I don't remember, but he's...
No, that's right.
If I remember correctly, he's in a canoe and there's all this pollution destroying the waterway. And at the very end, he's crying into the camera. And it was like this cultural moment, this commercial was. But the DDT, it was such a massive deal. It's like the thing now they do where they show, you know, the polar bears don't have any ice to walk on. Multiply that by about 100. And that was the DDT thing. Interestingly enough, DDT, you got death's doors there, 44 with the double D. But all this information about how all the things that laid eggs were dying because the DDT was making their shells thin and everything else that went on with it. But so all the way back in 62, Silent Spring is published. Where are we now? Now we're looking at, it's rare if you see someone in their late 70s or 80s who isn't suffering from dementia. which I think there's becoming a common idea that that's heavy metals in the brain and microplastics. So this idea in the 60s, which is in the very same vein of we got to quit screwing with nature, we've got to take the truths of nature and follow them, it's just gotten worse and worse as we went along. And the very arguments that she is making back then of the industries who create these things that do so much damage, look where we are. It's only gotten worse.
In 1963, the Beatles are already becoming a cultural phenomenon, and the following year of 1964 would be considered the beginning of the British invasion in the United States. Their explosion on the world stage gave them considerable influence that extended far beyond music, as they were shaping fashion, attitudes, and youth culture. The Beatles would begin experimenting with Indian music and spirituality after encountering Indian culture during their travels, which would greatly amplify interest in Indian philosophies. While all four members of the band seemed to have an interest, George Harrison, who is called the most spiritually inclined Beatle, is said to have begun exploring Indian music in 1963 after encountering sitar music during travels or through cultural exchanges in London's burgeoning bohemian scene. His interest is said to have been sparked by exposure to Indian classical music, possibly through radio, records, or performances by Indian artists like Ravi Shankar, who was gaining recognition in the West and would continue to do so throughout the 1960s. George Harrison's interest in Indian music is what is said to have led him to explore its spiritual underpinnings, and he began reading about Hinduism and Indian philosophy, possibly through texts like the Bhagavad Gita or works by Swami Vivekananda, which would have been available in London's esoteric bookstores. As the world's biggest band, the Beatles' interest in Indian culture would be reaching millions of eager minds who were hungry for all things Fab Four. Even their early tentative experiments in 1963 would generate a media buzz, introducing Indian aesthetics to fans. Beatlemania made the Beatles trendsetters for 1960s youth, and it is no overstatement just how influential this rock band, one that has many questions about their real origins and how things were actually going down behind the scenes, was on society. Their curiosity about Indian music and spirituality signaled that Eastern philosophies were cool, encouraging fans to explore yoga, meditation, and Indian texts. The Beatles' early look into Indian culture was laying the groundwork for more explicit Indian-inspired works that would be coming, such as Within You, Without You in 1967, which directly referenced Hindu philosophy, and their 1967 Transcendental Meditation Training with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi.
There he is. He's a fraud. I wish I could have fortune right now to talk a little bit about what a fraud that was. But let's back up and start from the beginning. 1963 is where this paragraph starts. And I'm glad you used the language British invasion. It was exactly that. The Beatles, and this is completely my point of view, the Beatles are a Tavistock construction, or something very akin to a Tavistock construction. They were created to become the biggest band in the world. And I would ask a simple question. If the mainstream didn't like the Beatles, like back then, they played like they didn't like them. Their hair is too long. They're corrupting our youth. And yet they were on the news every night. As a matter of fact, you could make the argument that the media coverage is what blew them up into the biggest band in the world. But in my view, this is rightly called a British invasion. It was planned to do that. It was planned to start to deal with the youth who wanted a better world, and it did that very deftly. But there were two British invasions from my point of view. The second one is in, I think it's 1980 when MTV hits. When MTV hits in America, why is it that like 90% of all the music and videos is coming out of England? We have Hollywood here. I remember seeing Van Halen's first music video, and it looked like it was filmed on a potato cam with a caveman running the reel. It was that bad. And so to get back to the point, this construct called the Beatles, which were blown up into the biggest thing in the world intentionally from my point of view, starts to integrate spirituality Indian ideas and basically taking control to steer the young generation in the wrong way. And by the way, the last thing that you mentioned here was Beatlemania. There's a number of people who have done a very good job of showing what a put-up Beatlemania was, what a construct. It existed on film. Well, it did bleed into the real world to some degree after the fact.
I think the safest thing to say is that they did a lot to construct Beatlemania, but it certainly became a very real thing once it did its job.
I remember seeing someone who had broke down one of the screaming girl shots that had become so popular, and they were laughing because they were saying that was 100 people put there and directed to do that. And the way it was presented, it made it look like there were a stadium of people. And of course, who can forget why the Beatles quit touring? One of the reasons they're told, and by the way, this is just a few years later, the Beatles quit touring. This is 63 and 64. They become worldwide. Do you know, is it 66, Jason, when they quit touring?
1966, yep.
So 2-3 years later, they quit touring. And one of the reasons is, well, there's so many screaming kids out there, we can't hear ourselves over the amplifiers. But I don't make any bones about it. This was social engineering, and it was intended to do what it did. And it did it like a dream. I can't imagine an operation going better than what the Beatles did in this world. There's probably no corner of the world that isn't aware of who the Beatles are.
So that's going to do it for hour one. When we come back for hour two, we're going to be getting into a very, very interesting situation that really had a lot to do with kicking off a lot of the aspects of the counterculture, and that is Ken Kesey and the whole Merry Pranksters situation with everything they were doing to push the normalization of psychedelics.
And also on the FBI payroll, which includes members of the Grateful Dead. I've also seen research that indicates CIA involvement, but I guess it's a known fact that they were on the FBI's payroll. Anyhow, you ready to wrap up hour one?
Yes, let's wrap hour one.
All right, let's wrap it. This has been hour one of episode 629. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode, and they get access to all the forums and comments. They can create complete new topics or top-level topics, and they can stream the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon anytime they like. That covers all my older telescope work, to include all the lunar waves, the discovery of the second sun, and a litany of bizarre UFO-like things, to include chemtrails and orbs. Also on the site is available all my still work from my gigantic solar telescope. People wanted stills from the images I shoot. Those are available on the site. Lastly, all members of crow777radio.com get exclusive access to my current solar work and my search to prove there is, in fact, a second sun. There are currently 15 member videos posted from where I started a year ago up to the current month. With that, we'll be back shortly for hour two, and I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers. We'll be right back.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.